I started my professional writing career in 1971. I was 18 years old. I came to Nashville. I had a tape that I made at home, about 12 songs. And I played it for half a dozen publishing companies, and nobody batted an eye. So I was sort of down, getting desperate, and I was running out of dough. So my last call was Tree Publishing Company, and the guy said, "Well, you have a tape?" Because that's what they all want to hear, is a tape. And I thought of my little tape, which had been batting zero every other place, and I said, "No, I don't have a tape. I'm just going to have to come in and play it for you." I don't know what possessed me. And he said, "Well, you know, we usually don't do that, but okay." So I waltzed in there and screwed up my courage and sat down and played him, you know, three or four songs. And he seemed to really like it. They said, "What do you want?" So I said, "I want $25 a week like Bob Frank gets." And they said, "Okay." So I went to work writing songs for Tree for $25 a week. Well, let's see. I wrote for Tree for 5 years. I started to kind of fall. There was kind of an underbelly scene going on in Nashville, as there always has been. And so I kind of fell in with these characters. There was this little club that we all sort of hung around called the Exit Inn. We just hung out there. We'd play writers' nights and, you know, listen to each other's songs. And so that was sort of my creative learning ground. And then the other side of that coin was the world at the publishing company, which was quite different. It was more sort of these expert craftsmen, you know, applying their craft in a very professional but very precise and soulful manner. Guys like Curly Putnam, who wrote Green Green Grass at Home, and I mean, there were classics being written right under my nose, and of course I was such a knucklehead, I didn't really notice it at the time, but I feel like just because I was there, I think, just by osmosis, you know, I think I picked up a few things from these great writers. I hooked up with a guy named Travis Rivers, so he hooked me up with Epic Records. The New York guy from Epic was coming through town, and Don Ellis was his name, and he said, you know, come play for this guy. So I went in and played him some songs, and they gave us a little budget to make a few singles. And being the thrifty Midwestern types, we cut an album's worth of material for about $3,000. So they said, "Well, that's the cheapest album we'll ever put out." So they put it out, and that was my first record in 1974. Well, my first cut was real exciting, and it was anything but big. It was big for me because I had such admiration for the artist, but commercially speaking, it was not any huge success. Tracy Nelson recorded a song of mine called "Thinking of You," which is a tune I wrote when I was 17, and so I was real excited, and I felt like, all right, I'm a professional. I'm a songwriter now. You know, I'm credible. You know, mom and dad can even believe that I'm actually doing something. You know, so, and it felt really good just to be, you know, recognized. I think the first sort of commercial success and probably one of the bigger ones, as I come to think of it, in terms of like hit, was this Three Dog Night song that I had recorded, a song called "Sure as I'm Sitting Here." The only other pop hit, quote unquote, single I've had was "Angel Eyes" of Jeff Healey Band, which went to about 5. And so I thought, okay, great. You know, people are hearing something, you know, that I'm doing. And so that was very satisfying. Well, I spent 5 years in Nashville learning how to write songs, learning how to drink and take drugs. Large quantities, and having a blast. You know, I was in my 20s and life was good. It worked. And all of a sudden, I was up to $250 a week at Tree and had two records out, and, you know, I could only go up. Well, it all came to a halt at once. Epic dropped me. Tree said, "See ya." No more $250 a week. And so it was like, oh my God, I gotta go get a real job or something. And so I had met this guy from Wisconsin, and he was a booking agent. He had done a few, he booked me a few gigs over a year or two period of time. I called him and I said, you know, I gotta work, so can you get me some work? So that sort of began my apprenticeship at playing live the way I see it now, you know. And I spent the next 3 years basically on the road, just all over the country. I'd play a lot of college stuff, you know, whatever passed for a coffee house. You know, I was playing college lunchrooms while they were eating their cheeseburgers. I was playing the basement coffee house, Kiva or whatever, you know. Just being a folk singer, a troubadour. And it was a real struggle for about the first year. And I was, you know, I was shy and, you know, I had a bad attitude and and I was scared. And I remember I used to just sort of sit on a chair and kind of hunch over and not look at anybody and just sort of sing into my shirt sleeve, you know. And of course, needless to say, it wasn't exactly going down a storm. I had a gig with George Thorogood. So George was opening the show, and he started out sitting down, and it was kind of bubbling along. All of a sudden, he kicks out the stool and he's standing up, and it was like Moses and the Red Sea parting, you know. It was like the audience just went, "Whoa, we're listening now," you know. And I don't know if it was conscious on my part, but I took that in, and I says to myself, "John, why don't you stand up? Because you feel like one of these damn butterflies on display here, pinned, you know. Why don't you stand up? Get mobile." And so I did. And that was sort of the beginning of my actually being able to start getting free and out of myself. The challenge for me when I'm on the road is to keep the music alive, because the road wants to kill the music, because music's live and a good thing, and the road is meant to wear you down. So it's hard sometimes, but you know, that's what we go for. I see an end to road years, you know, and so like everything else, when you start to get in your mid-40s, you know, things speed up. And you start to realize that a year goes by in about 10 minutes, and that you start to look at the possible. You can see that there's going to be an end to this road trip thing. So it has the effect of making it more precious and valuable, important to you while you're doing it. When I go in to make a record, there's not a whole lot of directing or massaging, cajoling, you know, the music into some kind of a shape that I've got in my brain somewhere, you know. I'm not one of those kind of people. I kind of like to just let the songs kind of hopefully take the lead, you know, and tell us where they want to go. So it's just a product of the material, the body material I have together, and what I've been through over that year or two personally, along with, you know, as a sort of a subplot to go along with the body of work, you know. And that all sort of adds up to, well, here we are in the studio, and it's like taking a picture of, you know, the kid growing up. It's like, well, here he is now. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. So I didn't know who the sort of color commentator, which is what I refer to Dave Immergluck, the guitar player, who he's sort of like my duet partner, you know. And I didn't even know how he played. I had never worked with him before. We lost our guitar player at the last minute. Mike Ward wanted to go off and do a little power trio thing and do his own material. So I had asked Davey Farragher and Michael Urbano, the bass player and drummer, respectively, to suggest somebody. And they said, well, this guy Dave Immerg looks great. He used to play with Camper Van Beethoven. I thought, well, I like them pretty good, so... and he was the right guy. We sat down and did, I think one of the first things we cut was Wrote It Down and Burned It. And he did that stuff on the steel guitar, and I thought, well, if he's taking us down, I'm going down with him. I had a tape of about, 24 songs, 25 songs that we were selecting. And we would just come in, somebody would say, how about, let's try this one. It was just like that, you know, sitting down and just, or standing up in the case of a lot of them, and just playing them, seeing where they went. There's a point at which, you're almost relying on your artistic ego to overcome the immense fears that inevitably come out of funding your own project. But a lot of it too, you know, I let a lot of people in on this project, and I let a lot of people do their best, and so that was a good thing. You know, I got a lot of good stuff out of a lot of people that worked on this. Davey Farragher, the bass player, and he really worked with me on the production, you know, on the musical settings that we were going to put these things in. He could see the shape, you know, a lot of times before I could. So he's like a real good, he's like one of them resonator guitarists, you know, a dobro. He's the dobro man. The only thing I require is an instrument, usually. You know, I almost never write lyrics first. I mean, once in a blue moon, I'll have a lyrical idea that I carry around with me, and eventually it turns into a song. I'm working on one now called That Queasy Hollywood Feeling. I don't really, the days of having, you know, clever titles or a cool little line are pretty much over for me. I need a guitar or a piano, and it's kind of like getting in the space capsule and taking a little ride, seeing where you go. You know, I sort of let the music blow me around, and then if it, you know, if you stumble onto something, if you catch a bit of wind, you know, and it keeps you up for a while, then you tend to remember it, or play it over and over, or get fascinated with it, or maybe sometimes even obsessed with it, but, you know, kind of go along with it, and then there comes a point at which you go, okay, not verbally to yourself, but it seems like you reach a point where the next step is, okay, I'm going to write some words so I have something to sing, because I'm singing, you know, I'm grunting or singing nonsense or oohs and ahs, and I like this melody, and I'm gonna tell a little story now to go along with it.